You're listening to Screen Heroes on the Heroes Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Screen Heroes, your film and TV podcast here on the Heroes Podcast Network. I am your regular host, Derek, and I have with me my two lovely regular co-hosts, Ryan.
Hello.
And Ray.
Sup, sup.
Sup, sup. This week, we got a big episode for you. We're changing up the format just a little bit. Our main topic today is Project Power, the superhero flick from Netflix starring Jamie Foxx and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. So that'll be after the first break. Of course, we will start with entertainment news. But then after everything, at the tail end of the episode, we're going to talk for a little bit about the latest from The Mandalorian on Disney Plus. So that way, if you haven't watched it yet or whatever, you can listen till then and then you can hop off. We promise to give spoiler warnings before we go on that. All right. So news this week, what do we got going on in the world of entertainment? So lots of different things. We got a brand new kind of trailer for Justice League, the Snyder Cut, or Zack Snyder's Justice League, or whatever we're calling it these days. This new trailer actually has two different versions, depending on where you watched it. There is a black and white version, but the one uploaded to YouTube on HBO Max's channel is not in black and white. And that was the version I saw. So I was very confused when I saw people talking about it being in black and white. But do you guys have any thoughts about this new trailer and the tiny amount of additional footage?
I actually had no idea that there was a new trailer, apart from hearing some stuff and seeing some GIFs today while I was at work. But I'm glad we finally got the question answered about the hologram that we saw in the old theatrical cut trailer that everybody was like, is that Supergirl? Is that, who is that?
No, it's just Superman. Yeah,
just like everybody thought it was, except for the weird people that thought it was Supergirl for some reason.
The weird people. To be fair, he has said, Snyder has said that he wanted to bring in Supergirl into the DCEU. So,
in all fairness, Snyder wants to bring in everyone.
Yeah. And not only that, he did leave an open pod in Man of Steel. You could see it in the ship. There was a second pod on his ship or something like that. And everybody thought that was Kara, but who knows? Yeah. But it was nice to get that answer that it was Superman the whole time.
Right. Anything from you, Ray?
Honestly, I couldn't figure out what was the new stuff.
The hologram.
Okay.
That was basically it.
Sweet.
No,
there
the,
you go, guys.
The kids playing football on the street. That was a new shot.
Okay.
And then I think the Themyscira shot was a new shot. I'd have to do a straight up comparison, but it was very minimal what was added in that. I think it was just a re-release of the trailer, basically, because there were rights issues.
That's
for Hallelujah the first time.
I mean, yeah, that's my only issue still, is that song does not go with anything ever.
That unless version, you're Zack Snyder, then it goes with everything ever.
I love that song. I love that so much. But there are like 10 million different versions of it that would be better.
And Zack Snyder's goal is to have that every one version, every different movie that he does, and eventually he'll get to all 10 million versions.
That version is just so off-putting. It's not sexy. It's not I guess grandiose. It's just creepy. So
yeah, it's definitely like the worst, one of the worst versions I've heard. Maybe not the worst, but it's not one that I would have picked.
Right.
I mean, that's fair. I think the rights issue probably came because he didn't realize he has to keep buying rights to the song. Like he probably thinks he paid for it
once, now he owns it forever.
Don't they have like a legal team that's supposed to decide that kind of, or figure out that kind of stuff?
Absolutely.
I mean, you would think
so. Why is it on Zack Snyder to figure that out?
I mean, I guess it depends how they're like releasing these trailers, right? Like, this is a weird situation in general. Maybe it's just him in a room and he's like, all right, trailer, go. I don't know.
Who knows? I don't know what goes on in his head, but I do like to see it once it's all said and done.
Yeah, that's fair.
As long as you don't have to hear it.
I don't want to hear that song.
But he's had it in basically every movie. It really stood out in 300 to me. I'm not sure why. why they had it in there, but
Jesus.
Now so, somebody needs to make like a recut of like the 300 trailer with that song.
Absolutely.
I'm sure somebody has. That's probably gotta be out there.
I mean, I'd be fine with like us doing that.
There you go.
So we learned a couple other little things about the Snyder Cut this past week. First, we learned that the new footage that was shot this fall, which was the quote reshoots that they were scheduling for this fall that several actors were coming back in for, is only going to amount to about 4 to 5 minutes of footage. My guess, this is just a guess, is that it's really going to be just to bridge the gap between the different parts because it wasn't originally designed that way.
That's my guess. That makes sense.
Could be, or I've seen the theory that it's to set up something at the end. Mm. You know, some new project.
That might explain why they wanted to do some stuff with Ezra Miller specifically. And the other piece of the news is that Ezra's in London filming Fantastic Beasts and the third one. And Zack Snyder got to shoot with him on the soundstage for Fantastic Beasts using a virtual presence device and the film crews over at Fantastic Beasts, which is really just some fun COVID pandemic era stuff right there.
Yeah, it's cool that he was able to do that and get what he needed. And it's cool that it was another Warner Brothers production. So, you know, the big daddies at Warner Brothers had to be like, you guys are doing this, make it happen.
Right. Like, I want to be on one hand, I want to say, like, man, this is just a cool cooperation. But yeah, it's no, the same
no,
they were forced to do it by the bosses. Yeah.
Daddy right? Warner.
Do you think exactly. It's like all it takes at this point is for Zack Snyder to be like, hey, I need Ezra for 10 minutes. And everyone's like, OK, how do we do that?
Yes, right? Because we want to stop spending money on this movie. So let's get him whatever he needs so we can be done with it.
Mm-hmm. So you say that, but every like 6 weeks, there's more money that's being spent on the movie. So I don't right. even know at this point.
I don't feel like they're setting up so that there's no way it's actually considered successful, like monetarily.
On purpose?
Yeah.
Well, we spent so much money, we just assumed we wouldn't recoup.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know. It's going to show us a loss no matter what, how good or how bad it is.
I guess it depends, right? We don't know. It's hard to know the full cost of the film at any point. And then we don't know what the marketing budget was the first time, let alone this time for the Snyder Cut. It's a very weird,
yeah,
very weird situation. But I mean, there you have it. Continuing with like the DC stuff. So this, I'm going to want your opinion on this one, guys. Wonder Woman.
Okay.
It's the last, Wonder Woman 84 is the last major film release scheduled in 2020. Everybody else is pushed at this point, right? New guy pushed and the Nile movie pushed. Everything else is pushed. There's now been some talks that maybe Wonder Woman would either be released or like with a short theatrical window or basically simultaneously with an HBO Max release, rather than just continuing to get pushed like the other major blockbusters have, you know, like Black Widow, for example, or Bond 25. What do you guys, first off, what do you think is going to happen? But what do you want to have happen if those are not the same?
I mean, I don't know. What my personal opinion is that I would much rather watch it sitting at home in my PJs, you know, with my dog in my lap, rather than go to a movie theater full of sick people coughing on each other. So yeah, I would prefer an HBO Max release, but Patty Jenkins has come out and said that they will never release on a streaming service because it's meant to be viewed in the big screen and everything else. So I don't know. I mean, they probably will end up making it an HBO Max release because, you know, we kind of talked about it earlier in our chat. I think it was in our chat, but you can't just have money sitting out for so long without getting something back for it, or else it starts to feel like a loss, even if it isn't going to be in the long run. So,
right.
I have to agree. I think the longer that these movies just lie in wait and I know they're ready, the more I just want to see them. I don't want to wait for the world to be healthy again, because honestly, the U.S. does not have their shit together, and it'll be a while before this country is safe enough to do that. So I think just sitting on product like that is a mistake. And I am ready to see these films.
That's fair. Yeah, I'm with you guys on that. One thing I maybe think they could do, depending on when they decide to release and what the state of COVID is at that point in time, but the Bill and Ted method I thought was smart. They released simultaneously in theaters and VOD. And so that way, the limited seating that theaters have and the people who have access to them could have that option if they choose to go. And then the rest of us could rent it or purchase it through VOD and watch it, you know, this at the same time, essentially. And I know we all kind of want it to go to HBO Max because we're already paying for that. But I do think that the VOD plan would be a little more realistic. They can charge the $20 for it that everybody else would normally charge for it and recoup at least some of that. Right. Because even, you know, if two people see every one of those, it's still $10 a person instead of zero. Right. Yeah. So that's kind of what I expect to see. And I'd be fine with that. Obviously, perfect world is HBO Max, but I don't have a problem renting a big movie like Wonder Woman 84.
I don't have a problem with it either. But yes, what our ideal was. So I'd be happy to.
Well, I asked both. I asked what you thought would happen and what would be ideal. Fair. And that's what I think is going to happen. I think they'll do a theater and VOD simultaneous release depending on the state of COVID. If COVID's as bad as it is right now when they release, I think it'll just be straight VOD.
I think I'd pay like $20, but any more than that, I don't know if I'd be willing to go for it.
Yeah, and that's the standard. I mean, Mulan was the outlier at 30. That was a high price. Everybody else has been 20.
Yeah. I would like to keep it. If I pay $20, I would like that to be mine, but I completely understand if that's also a rental.
Yeah, that seems to be the rental price. Usually the purchase price is $24.99 instead of $19.99. So you rent it for $19.99, purchase it for $24.99. You know, I'm with you there because it's going to end up on HBO Max. I'm a little less particular about that because it'll end up being available to me anyway. And if I'm going to own it, I'd rather have a physical copy.
Classic Derek.
Classic. Yeah. All right. Well, the last bit of DC news, because this is just crazy that it kind of came up at all, is Peter Stormare came out and said that there's a sequel in the works for his and Keanu Reeves' version of Constantine, which coincidentally we reviewed earlier this year for its anniversary. Did you guys think that this was even a remote possibility? I think we've joked about it.
I mean, I think at this point it's silly to think that there's nothing that's a remote possibility. You know, everything is possible, you know. I don't know. I like the movie. It just isn't like super close to Constantine other than the name. But if, you know, I can get past that, it's fine. It's a cool character. And, you know, I think we were all a little disappointed that it never got a sequel when we talked about it earlier this year. So it'd be cool, but I kind of, if I had my choice, I would kind of ask them to abandon that and do something that's a little closer to its roots, a little more comic accurate, because that's what I would want personally. But I'd be okay. I wouldn't be shooting down at Constantine 2 with Keanu if it was going to be a real thing.
Again, I completely agree. I would have loved a sequel back closer to when the movie came out. But since that didn't happen, at this point, I've kind of gotten addicted to Matt Ryan's portrayal, and I would love to see him included. A sequel at this point feels to me like they want to include Keanu in the DCEU before Marvel can get their hands on him. And if that's the case, if that's the plan, then, you know, they better act fast. Because right now, Keanu is box office gold. And that's just really what companies are looking at, obviously. Like, the only reason people are talking about Constantine 2 is because Keanu is on a hot streak right now. So, if they do it, I hope it's good. The character was fun. Peter Stormare as Lucifer was great. I would love them to bring back Rachel Weisz. Her character was awesome, but yeah,
Peter Stormare was absolutely a highlight of that movie, and he was probably one of the best portrayals of the devil in film, period, in my opinion. And he only got like 10 minutes or something of screen time.
So, yeah, one scene, and he kills it.
Yeah, at the very least, seeing more of him as the devil would be worth it. You know,
I agree.
Just keep him and reboot the Constantine character. Like I said, as much as I love Keanu, I'd like to see something a little more comic accurate.
Well, you don't even need Keanu, but the problem is that the same character is currently on a Netflix show. You know, Peter Stormare and the one on Netflix, that Lucifer, are technically the same character. Neil Gaiman created them both. Or created the same guy, so it could get a little dicey as to who they want to continue in the DCEU, if they want to continue anybody. But yeah, Peter Stormare was just absolutely insanely good. As soon as he steps on screen, your eyes are like drawn to him.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Peter Stormare fan anyway, let alone as good as a job as he did in this. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have to worry about the casting stuff and multiple versions, because the DCEU is steering very hard into the multiverse.
Oh yeah. Right?
And that's both on the big and small screen. So I don't really see an issue with the Lucifer show and the Constantine character Lucifer being different. I don't think anyone's going to really care about that.
Okay.
For me, I mean, I agree with you guys 110% across the board. There's not a whole lot else to add there. Other than I'm just surprised that this came up now and we were just talking about it earlier this year. I thought it was kind of fun. I'm never going to say no to a Keanu Reeves movie. So if they want to bring him back, I'm there for it.
And you're the reason why everybody wants him right now. You know, you're the reason why he's box office gold. You and millions more. Like, it's not just you.
Because I love him. Like, he's great. And I think he's only gotten better as an actor over time.
Oh, yeah. And,
you know, it's been 15 years since that Constantine movie, so the character can evolve and change too, and he's not gonna, you know, have the accent or anything that Matt Ryan's version of the character has, at least I hope not, because there'd be no explanation for it. But the character can change and become more accurate to the comics during those 15 years, so there's that possibility. If mm-hmm. you're curious what our thoughts are on the 2005 Constantine movie, you can check out episode 194 from back in mid-March, right before our COVID break. Actually, that was the last episode we did, so you can go and listen to our 15th anniversary retrospective. All right, well, we've got one last thing. It's not really news, it's more just an update for you guys. So WandaVision is officially premiering on January 15th of 2021, so it is not a 2020 release as we had originally thought. So with that in mind, we have decided that we are actually going to review each episode as it releases. That's not something we've done before on this show. We've done entire season recaps, we've done arc reviews, you know, like when the Arrowverse does a big crossover, but we've never done every episode of a particular season, and we are going to do that with the first season of WandaVision. It is 6 episodes, so we'll be doing 6 episodes reviewing WandaVision, starting with our episode the following week. So the live stream on January 19th or the release on the 21st. That's what we will be talking about. We'll still do news. We might still do some other things, but that's what we're going to do, is we're going to be reviewing WandaVision week by week as it releases in 2021.
And don't think of it as a strict review. It's, you know, it's going to be a discussion and talk about Easter eggs that we may have noticed, and, you know, theories on what's coming up in the series and whatnot. And let's get real. I mean, COVID is affecting our station or our podcast just as much as affecting everybody else. So, yeah, I mean, we want to do things that people want to listen to, and, you know, not everybody wants to listen to our reviews of shitty old movies or whatever we happen to be reviewing that week. So yeah, we're just trying to try something new, and if people like it, then that's great and we'll keep doing it, and if not, then maybe we'll still keep doing it, who knows. But yeah, if you like it, make sure you give us feedback and that you want us to do more of that.
Mm-hmm. Anything you'd like to add, Ray?
I am not quite sure I remember agreeing to episode by episode, but I'm good with it, so I'm on board.
We actually have a contract that Rachel signed.
It's called Facebook saying, Messenger.
Yeah, it's Facebook Messenger, where she agreed to do this, so yes. Don't let her fool you.
Yes.
It is happening.
That's right.
I'm fine with that. Like, I'm not upset.
But you're a Marvel girl, so we need you.
Yeah, yes. You're our expert.
I have to point out all the Easter eggs for you guys.
That's right, because I won't notice them.
The thing is, you guys will probably notice the MCU stuff, because right. I don't pay attention to that as much. But I'm going to be the one over in the corner who absolutely is, like, squealing over all the comic stuff.
That's what we need. We need you there for that.
We'll also probably dive into some of the wider entertainment stuff that they touch on, like the shows that they're parodying and some of the techniques that they're using, because there's some pretty cool stuff that I think is very unique to not only, superhero stuff, but just modern television in general. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they do.
So Ryan's on the MCU Easter eggs. I'm on the comic Easter eggs, and Derek's on the technical applications.
I don't know that I agreed to that part. Yeah. I mean, geez, that's a lot of pressure.
It is. And my thing may be over at some point. You know, they may just stop. They might drop that at some point.
They may stop making the show.
But they might
stop.
There'll
be no production anymore.
They're going to stop referencing or parodying or you know, things like that. The older shows, like, you know.
But it'll still have technical applications.
Yes, that is true. But that's not
Derek,
what
you're
I
not
said.
Getting out of this. Stop trying to get out of
what
it.
I was talking about. But it's fine. It's fine. You know what? We're going to go take a break. And when we come back from our break, we're talking Netflix's Project Power. And then after that, we'll be talking a bit about The Mandalorian. We will be right back. All right, and we are back to talk Project Power. Project Power is a Netflix movie that came out earlier this year, actually in August. It stars Jamie Foxx and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It doesn't have a theatrical release or anything like that, so we're not talking numbers or that sort of thing. But the quick synopsis for anybody who may not be familiar with what this is, and this spoiler warnings for Project Power, I suppose. When a pill that gives its users unpredictable superpowers for 5 minutes hits the streets of New Orleans, a teenage drug dealer and a local cop must team up with an ex-soldier to take down the group responsible for its creation. So that is the general synopsis on IMDb. All right, guys, let's do this. What was your initial overall thoughts, impressions, feelings?
I really liked the movie. I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought it was able to show superheroes from a different culture. The movie was definitely more from a Black point of view, and I think that is very important for, you know, obviously the diversity of film. And I absolutely adored the story. I thought they were able to show some powers in a really unique way. The stretchy guy towards the end, you know, we've seen stretchy powers multiple times, but this actually made them seem formidable.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. You know, I have some big complaints about it too, but overall, I always have enjoyed, and I've talked about on the show before, the concept of random people, like each person getting a unique power. You know, there's a book series called Wild Cards that has a similar premise where it's an alien virus that for some people makes them evil and like turns them into a monster, and for some people it makes them like a superhero. You know, and there's series of books where everybody's born with a specific magical ability. And it could be that you pee, you know, in different colors, or that you spit, you know, alcohol or something like that. Or it could be that you can grow plants really big, like poison ivy or something like that. And, you know, those were book series that I enjoyed as a kid. And so anything that's like random powers always gives you the hope that, you know, maybe I have something like that in me. And so I kind of, I've always liked that. And I think this movie executed it pretty well. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than I anticipated. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. I think that definitely seeing all the different types of powers was cool. And the way they were portrayed was pretty impressive, especially given that this was a Netflix movie and not like a massive blockbuster. I don't have budget information, unfortunately, so I don't know what they spent on
this. I don't think Netflix releases that, do they?
Not usually, no. So that's a little disappointing. So I can't really put this in perspective with another film to compare it to for a baseline. But I thought the effects looked really solid, right? When the bank robber guy is got the chameleon powers and stuff, I thought that was just really well done. And you know, the sequences of the drug taking effect and everything maybe were a little more cliche, a little less original. But the powers themselves being shown were really kind of realistic, gritty, unique. It felt very, I don't know, it felt kind of like a slightly better incarnation of what we've seen from the live action X-Men movies.
Mm-hmm.
From that standpoint, just the powers themselves. You know, there's a few little issues that I have here and there, but yeah, overall I was really happy with this. I thought that the main cast, Jamie Foxx, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Dominique Fishback, did a really good job. I was floored to find out that Dominique is actually, she was 29 when this movie was made. That was really surprising to me. She does not appear to be like 30, but, you know, I thought that was just kind of interesting. What did you guys think of the pill itself? Like how it worked, you know, it was timed for 5 minutes. The vast range of it working either really well or really, really badly, how it was portrayed. What do you guys think of the pill?
So I have thoughts. First of all, the way they made it look never makes me want to take it. I don't, because like something about it having a mechanical aspect to it, you know, you have to twist it to activate it. And it's exactly 5 minutes, which, you know, medicine doesn't work like that. No drugs work like that. Everybody's just a little different. It's like, oh, this may kick in. It may not. It may do this. It may not. Which to me is completely inconsistent with the you don't know what power you're getting. It seems like if they've got that down, you should be able to buy certain powers. Now, the powers themselves were really cool. It sucks that some people's DNA was completely, I guess, incompatible to the pill, and they ended up, you know, ODing and exploding. Or, you know, that one woman who froze to death. The movie started and I was like, yeah, I'd probably take that pill. It'd be really difficult for me not to. And then I see it and I'm like, nope, nope, nope. Giant pass. So that's where I'm at on the pill itself.
I thought it was cool. I was on the opposite end where I think that it's not something that you've seen explored a lot, having a pill be mechanical rather than, you know, just something that dissolves in our body or whatever. And I think it's a little easier for me to swallow, so to speak, the 5 minute time when it's something that's regulated by mechanics rather than just your body's digestive system.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I thought the pill was neat looking. And I like the fact that you had to turn it to activate it. And, you know, I thought that was not something I've really seen before in movies. So I thought that was cool.
Yeah, I'm back and forth on it. Cause I'm somewhere in the middle with you guys. So I guess you have to, what, you have to like poop out the metal part. It's the mechanical part at some point.
Probably. I mean, I don't think that's really important to the story, so I didn't really think about it, but
I mean, I think it depends how many of those you take, you know, could get important after a little while.
Because of you. Now I have to picture Joseph Gordon-Levitt having shrapnel poops and I'm very upset with you.
I'm sorry. I'm very sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, you should be. That was horrible.
I apologize. I do. It did look cool, though. It definitely didn't look like something I'd want to put inside my body either. But, you know, I thought that it was a neat way of showing it. It kind of took the next step from Limitless. Did you guys see Limitless at all? So that was not quite this level, of course, but the idea is you take this pill and it unlocks your brain's potential. It's another one of those, we only use 10% of our brain things. And this was like,
which if we did, we'd completely like fall over and be drooling and we couldn't like use anything. And yeah, no.
So this was just kind of the next evolution. I think the next step from what those pills looked like and the way those were portrayed. So I appreciated that. The twisting mechanism was really cool until they kind of ignored it in a pivotal scene, and that was a little disappointing. So when
you're talking about the Jamie Foxx scene,
yeah,
they didn't ignore it. He did it with his tongue.
Yeah,
he spun it with his tongue.
Yes. Yeah, you've seen people that can tie cherry stems in knots and okay. with their tongue. I'm pretty sure
So that's not the scene I was talking about, but I missed that he did that, so it answers the scene anyway. I was talking about the one where he was handcuffed to the chair still. But if he could do it with his tongue, then I guess it doesn't matter. I didn't realize that he did that. I missed that. Okay. Problem solved.
Done.
Now, this takes place in New Orleans, which for me, I thought was really cool because every freaking movie has to take place in like Chicago, New York, or LA. And mm-hmm. it's nice when I get to see something that is taken seriously, that is in kind of a sci-fi or superhero style genre, but in somewhere else, right? It's one of the reasons, you know, I love that Shazam was in Philly. I love that this is in a different city. This is in New Orleans. Did that do anything for you guys? I thought it was super cool.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'm on the same page. A huge issue I have with Marvel Comics is 90% of them all take place in New York City. And anytime they address the rest of the US or the rest of the world, even, they completely ignore any crime that happens there. They kind of blow it off. Like everything happens in New York. And it gets old. It gets repetitive. Like you can only see the Empire State Building drawn so many times. And I loved it. I love that they picked a different city and all the Saints references here and there. They really used the city to its full potential. And I thought the city was a decent character in itself.
I'm not really in the same camp as you guys. It was fine, but I thought they went like way too heavy with it. Mm. Like, I don't need 20 Katrina references in the span of an hour and a half to remind me that this is what New Orleans has been through. And that's not going to age well, because at a certain point, kids won't be really getting taught about Katrina and they won't remember it. You know, the Saints jersey and like, I don't know, it was a lot and it's fine. It was cool. If they had been more subtle with it, I think it would have been better for me, because I thought one thing this movie did really well, and I think you guys kind of touched on it, was showing us a different, like more urban, I guess, maybe is the term, life that we don't really see in superhero and sci-fi movies. Attack the Block did a good job with that, and this movie did a good job with that, but I think they went a little too heavy into that in a lot of points. But yeah, it was cool to see it in New Orleans. I just wish they hadn't been that heavy handed with it. I mean, it was a lot to deal with. And maybe if I lived in New Orleans and I could be like, yeah, New Orleans is cool seeing all this stuff. But, for me, it made me feel more like, oh, okay, I guess Kansas City's cool too. But, you know, cause you know, they're talking, this is not how we do it in New Orleans or whatever. His big line was Joseph Gordon-Levitt, where he's like, hyping up how this isn't how they do the year. That implies that everywhere else it's okay for you to come into our streets and like push a bunch of drugs and we're okay with it because we're not New Orleans. So I don't know. I felt kind of the opposite of you guys on most of it.
Fine.
I think that last bit about Joseph Gordon-Levitt is that problem where the cops are all corrupt except the one guy who's really just doing his job well.
But he's also corrupt because he's using drugs, illegal drugs.
Absolutely. I don't even think he denies it. Like, he doesn't think he's perfect. He says that he does bad things. So I actually don't think that there is the one cop who does the good work kind of thing. I think they lean into everybody's just a little bit bad here, at least a little bit bad, if not more.
I don't know. I think they look at that, right? Like they peel back that curtain and then they immediately take a step away from it by him saying, yeah, I do these bad things, but it's to help the people of New Orleans, right? It's kind of like the Batman or the Daredevil, you know, mentality, right? Where it's okay to do illegal bad things as long as it's to bad people. Or to save good people, right?
Yeah, so people are sociopaths.
So, I mean, like, I think it just follows that same trend or cliche, that trope of, well, it's okay to you're still the good guy if you're doing the bad stuff to stop the bad guys.
Right.
Right. You know, because like at the end of the day, New Orleans is not a small town, and we really only get two cops of any real significance in this movie because his partner is shot very early on and is immediately gone for the rest of the film. But it's him and the captain. The captain's on the take, so he's a bad guy, mm-hmm. right? And then you just have Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who's driving around in, I guess, what used to be a cop car with very, very little oversight, no partner. He wasn't assigned another partner or anything like that, who's just out at crazy hours doing his own thing. And, you know, it was just kind of interesting for them to paint it that way, because it seemed like the only way for a cop to do the right thing and do a good job in this scenario was to just be a complete vigilante.
Yeah. And to go buy drugs from a 15-year-old girl or however old she was supposed to be in the movie.
Yeah. So I wasn't I was a little unclear about their relationship and like how that got started. Right. Like, was she just his supplier, or were they doing other things like trying to catch other people or anything like that? Or was that just a transactional relationship?
I thought it was just a transactional relationship. And later in the movie, they touch on it. And he says, I think to her mom or somebody, that he does business with her daughter or something like that. So
I wasn't sure if that was just like cover or not.
Could have been. Movie doesn't really explain it. So it's kind of at our discretion to figure out what we want to think.
But overall, I mean, I thought Joseph Gordon-Levitt did a good job. I like seeing him in more action-heavy roles. I think he pulls it off well. I think he's a good actor, and he brings kind of a level of seriousness and confidence to the role, the same as Jamie Foxx, where it's just you can take it a little more seriously.
I, again, kind of disagree. I thought the girl was the best of the three of them, personally, and that Jamie Foxx and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, they were good for like, I would say like 80% of the movie, but then the other 20%, it was way overacted and took me out of it. Like, it was not believable that this person would act like this. You know, it was so far over the top. So that took me out of it a good amount. But yeah, I mean, I was really impressed with the girl. I don't know her from anything, I don't think. And she was the best of the three of them by far, in my opinion.
I honestly, I think the three of them have really good chemistry together. I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt is kind of a chameleon, or at least he's grown into it. I can see him in, you know, the Inception-like drama where he plays a suit. And this kind of drama where he plays an action hero, kind of gritty, grimy, that kind of thing. And Jamie Foxx, as an actor, I feel like he's completely underrated. Yes, I know he got an Oscar for Ray, but really since Amazing Spider-Man 2, things have kind of gone downhill for him. The stuff he's put out hasn't been that great. So I thought this was a much better showing of his acting style. He really deserves roles that are subtle because he brings out the strength and the subtlety. And then absolutely, Dominique did a great job as Robin. She was like just magnetic. My eyes went straight to her every time. I loved her rap, so I wanted more of that, so much more than that. I would watch a whole sequel. That's just like her 8 Mile. You know, we just watch her perform constantly. But everything that she did, she easily can be put into the Mary Sue trope that, you know, guys hate so much. But I think that it makes sense, you know? She sews up Jamie Foxx and she's like, oh, my mom works here. So I didn't know how to do my mom's job, but it doesn't sound contrived.
Yeah, it worked for me. I guess the stitching part, I didn't really think too hard about that. But you're right. That doesn't necessarily follow. I think maybe these three stand out even a little bit more because everybody else in the movie is completely expendable. You know, I think you could have put any other actor in any other role and nobody would have noticed. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not like no villain really stands out. You know, you've got like three villains, I guess, in this movie, but they're completely interchangeable. There's still very little to go off of about, you know, they're just bad. They're just the bad guys. And you've got Newt, who's very quickly gone anyway. And so, like, I just feel like there's nobody else in the movie. It's kind of like when you play a video game, you know, and you've got like you, and then there's like the NPC that you're trying to take through a place, and they're just, these are just disposable characters through the story. Does that make sense?
That's a good point. The villains were definitely forgettable, and almost everybody was forgettable. I thought the police cap or police chief or whatever, he was pretty good. But yeah, it was one thing I will say as a positive for this movie is that a lot of the predictions that I made early on were it didn't go with, like, as soon as I met the mom that was sick and like needed the medication, the soup, I was like, she's going to be dead in the next bit. And then that's going to probably fuel the girl on to going on and doing her thing. Fuel Robin, I think her name was, but you know, they didn't kill her off. And then as soon as I saw Joseph Gordon-Levitt's partner, I was like, well, that guy's going to die. That's going to, you know, because then he's going to need a new partner and Jamie Foxx is going to fit in that role. But he didn't die. He got shot, but and got sidelined for the rest of the movie. So he might as well have been dead, I guess. But the only like big prediction that they ended up doing was Jamie Foxx taking the pill. It's like, you know, I feel like it would have been more powerful if he hadn't taken the pill and had just figured a way around it so that it wasn't like everything is dependent on, you don't have to have this pill to win. Because like everything in the movie portrays taking the pill as a bad thing, but then they in the end had to have it to win. You know, they would have lost, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt would have gotten killed in 2 minutes, and then Jamie Foxx. I thought it was more powerful that Jamie Foxx was not taking the pill as like a, you know, like Batman doesn't kill kind of thing. Like he's not taking the pill, but he wants to beat people that will take the pill, and he does. So several times. So I mean, I don't know. I was kind of disappointed that they went that way, and it seemed a little too predictable. But I don't know. Did you guys feel the same way?
I really wanted, once he mentioned that he has the pistol shrimp's power, I really wanted to see it. So I'm kind of glad he did. And I had never heard of the pistol shrimp. I had to Google it after this. Okay, this is
going to answer a question for me, because I knew what a pistol shrimp was. I love them. I think they're super cool animals. But like, if for somebody who doesn't know what a pistol shrimp is, that line where he's like, the pistol shrimp. You know, like, and he's trying to talk all badass about a pistol shrimp. Like,
yeah,
they are badass. But to somebody like you who didn't know what a pistol shrimp was, did you still get that vibe, or did you not think that was cool until after you Googled it?
No, when he said it, I was like, please explain yourself, sir. And the way he explained it, it did sound really cool. So I thought it was movie contrivance, to be completely honest. Okay. I was like, there's no way that is a real animal that has that real effect. And but as soon as he said it, I was like, I want to see this. I want to see them do this. So I'm glad they did. And I'm glad when I Googled it, it was a real thing. And they can
crack fucking fish tanks with their claws. It's like a big problem with them. They're so powerful.
Yeah.
So I actually had to look it up because I thought they made a mistake, because there, I knew of a different shrimp called the mantis shrimp that has almost the exact same abilities. It's very, very, very similar.
Yeah.
And there's even like a bunch of articles comparing the two. So I thought they screwed up. So I was like, wait a minute. I thought it was something. Yeah. But so that was really interesting. I was totally fine with him using the pill if they had let him die. What ruined it for me was that he goes and he does it. It's a really cool sequence. I thought the special effects were great. I thought they did a really good job showing this very strange power that is not a human ability in any way, right? And it did a really cool job showing the guys disintegrate, the bullet melts, you know, and he brings the crane down. I thought it was really cool. And they had built up the whole time about what a sacrifice this is, how dangerous it is when he goes off on the pill. And I thought, you know, when he collapses at the end and Robin can't revive him, and then you know, Tracy, you see her walk by the little plant, right? And the plant kind of perks up and gets better earlier when, and during her escape. So I'm like, well, that's coming back. Yeah, and, but it failed, right? Her healing failed. I was like, man, that was really good. Like, they kind of built that up. They got up my expectations that it was just going to be another happy ending, but they're not going to do it. They're really going to stick to it. And then she just tries it again and it worked. And that kind of killed it for me.
Nah.
The part that killed it for me beyond what I already said, the predictability, was that somehow in the middle of this, he's disintegrating guys, disintegrating bullets, seemingly out of control, but yet somehow it manages to miss Robin, who's literally standing right next to somebody who disintegrates right next to her. But she's fine.
I wondered if he could kind of control it or aim
it.
He
talks about how out of control he is and like how he killed all these people before the last time he did it. But then he can control it enough to where, I don't know. It seems stupid.
The only reason that was okay for me, well, like there were two parts to it. One was he did throw something in that direction that hit the guy that she was next to. So it did show some level of control. But the other woman, the big bad, she also didn't die from it. She actually dies from him throwing the crane on top of her later. So since both of them survived it, it was more believable to me than just the good guy being okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I still don't buy it, but I understand your justification for it in your mind.
It felt less cheap that way. You know, I really think that this movie being gritty and dark and serious and doing a really good job balancing those emotions, having him die in the end to save his daughter, but also to save Robin and everything, I thought would have been a really fitting ending.
I just think the whole movie would have been more powerful if instead of them having to take the pills to beat the guys with the pills that they would, I don't know, I guess I tend to like superheroes that don't have powers that, you know, find creative ways to take out people that do have powers instead of just doing what they do and getting powers and doing it, you know, beating them at their own game. That's less exciting for me personally.
I mean, this movie is basically a tower defense movie from the point of the people attacking. You know, like he has to go through all these guys just to get to the big boss at the end, right? And the fact that he's able to do so without, you know, using any of that is pretty spectacular. And
getting captured doesn't really take a lot of work.
True. Very true.
I mean,
yeah, I mean, there's a few like tropey things that happen there, right? Like,
it's a superhero movie. It was going to have tropes. Like,
oh, sure.
There's no way it could be 100% unique.
Of course, 100%. It just, it has like the very big superhero failing, super villain failing of I've got the hero and I'm going to kill him, but like in 10 minutes.
Yeah, later I'm going to do it. I got to make him wait to watch this first.
I'm going to move him out of my sight so I have no idea what's going on and leave him with these two henchmen.
Two inept guards.
Or one guard by the end of it, right? And that's going to be that. And it just like, I don't know. I would have preferred that to be maybe a little bit different, but the boat stuff I thought was really cool. Having Robin have to walk Joseph's character through the doors and kind of unlock them and stuff, I thought was really interesting. And it's a different kind of setting. We don't normally get a setting like that in any of these movies. And I thought it worked really well from that standpoint.
I will say overall, the director of this movie was really interesting to watch. It reminded me of the first time I watched Creed and was really impressed at the interesting shots and the way it was filmed. I'm not familiar. I don't even know the director's name for this, but I was very impressed by whoever it was.
So there's two directors that are credited, Henry Joost and Ariel Schulman.
Well, I hope to see more from them because the scene is the one that really stands out to me. I thought most of the fight scenes were pretty lackluster, but the one where the girl is in the tank and you're seeing like out through the like kind of frosty windows, the action. And it's like moving window to window, almost like in a single shot. That was really interesting and cool and a fun way to fight that scene. And then like the kind of mid credit scene, whatever it was, with her like writing in the notebook. under the bridge. It was just like a really beautiful shot. It kind of reminded me of like Into the Spider-Verse, that kind of creativity. So there was a lot of shots like that where I was really impressed, and I hope to see more from.
I got that vibe too.
Yeah.
I really liked both those shots. The storytelling point of view with the inside the container where the woman is slowly freezing to death. I guess it wasn't that slow, to be completely honest.
No, it was pretty painful. You know,
it shows two things. One, it shows the mortality, the danger of this drug, and just how important it is to regulate it. And then it also shows that no one cares about her at this time. No one is going to help her. Nobody is going to fix this. Every single person in that room, it has a higher priority, including the guy she came with. You know, he's getting his ass kicked. Other people are getting shot to death, or, you know, stabbed with ice through the jugular. So it told two stories at once, which it's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, that shot was definitely my favorite from the whole movie. It was just a really creative way of showing an action scene and also pulling story into it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
that's fair. Is there anything else you guys want to touch on for Project Power before we move on to our Mando talk?
I would be interested in a sequel, you know, following Tracy and her unique powers. I would be definitely interested to see those particular directors get a hold of a bigger budget superhero film.
Definitely, you know, agree.
If they aren't approached to do, you know, television or Disney Mandalorian, or, you know, they could definitely direct a few episodes of the Justice League Dark show once that's a thing. I would adore that. And then, you know, possibly bigger, better stories.
Fair enough. Awesome. All right. Well, yeah. That's going to be it then for Project Power. Hope you enjoyed our conversation on that. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about The Mandalorian and stuff that's happened in the most recent episode, Chapter 11. So spoiler warnings for that. We'll be right back. All right, and we are back talking The Mandalorian. So the most recent episode, Chapter 11, was called The Heiress. And we thought it'd be fun to talk a little bit about this because our sibling show, Echo Station, covers Star Wars. That's what they are. They're a Star Wars podcast. And so they're doing what they call the Mandafezzo and are reviewing the episodes of The Mandalorian as they release bi-weekly. So you can get a new episode from them this week. They cover chapters 10 and 11 on that episode. So you can go check them out. Echo Station. But we also love Star Wars and we've really been enjoying The Mandalorian. So we thought we'd also talk a little bit about The Mandalorian.
And I think the things that they look at over there are a little different than the things we look at.
So definitely sometimes.
It won't be us saying the same stuff they did.
Well, we definitely have different perspectives, I think, you know, when we're talking Star Wars. So let's kick things off, guys. What do you want to touch on first here? There's some big, you know, low hanging fruit. There's some smaller stuff. Is there something that really caught your eye on Chapter 11?
Well, we could probably talk about all three of the episodes in Season 2, I'd imagine, because, sure. You know, we haven't at all.
Let's do it.
I think that the second episode was the worst of the three so far. It was definitely more of a filler episode, but it was still maintained, you know, some interest for me, obviously, being a Star Wars show. The first one was great with... Timothy Oliphant he's wonderful in basically everything I've ever seen him in. So, you know, having him come into the Star Wars universe was, and as a sheriff, essentially an Old West sheriff, was wonderful. I am a little worried that this show is just going to be like the same formula every season, like goes to planet, finds person to help him, then that person sends him on a quest, and then he comes back and gets whatever he meant. You know, like, it seems like that's the same thing quite often in the show, is, you know, what he ends up having to do. But as long as it maintains a certain level of, you know, I don't know what I'm trying to say, filmmaking, like, as long as it maintains a level of being good, then I'm okay with it to an extent. But it'll get a little long in the tooth if they don't mix it up a little bit, I think. Because the third episode was kind of suffering from that a little bit too.
That's fair. I definitely think the first episode was the best of the three so far as well. I really liked what they did with the Raiders, the Tusken Raiders.
Mm-hmm. It made them a little more, you know, personal.
Well, it made them out to just not be wild monsters, right? They have an entire culture. They have a language. They brought in people to help create this language. It's based on sign language. They have rituals. They have a code that they live by, you know? And I just thought that was a really cool way to take one of the first alien species we see in Star Wars and flesh them out into being something much more full and rich. I really like that a lot. And yeah, I mean, Timothy was amazing, right? Mm-hmm. He was fantastic.
And the fact that Boba Fett seems to be a Tusken Raider now, I thought was interesting. He had the Tusken rifle and the gaffa stick on his back when we saw him. And there was, if you watched the episode carefully, there when the Mandalorian was sitting around like the fire discussing strategy with the Tusken Raiders, there was one Tusken Raider that like sat further away. That I think that was Boba Fett.
Interesting. Cool theory.
But I mean, I don't know. Like that. He definitely, like, he's wearing Tusken Raider clothes when we see him and has the weapons of a Tusken Raider. So it seems likely that that's probably how he's been living since he escaped the Sarlacc.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Totally makes sense. Very believable.
I'm curious if they cover that in this show or if they wait until, like, if Boba Fett's done with this show and now is, you know, they'll do that in the next show. He can't be done. I'm sure they're gonna have to wrap that up. They wouldn't have put so much into it.
You'd think
leave it floating out there.
I would imagine. I definitely would. And I think that also lends to why I'm a little disappointed in like the episode length. Each episode's been shorter than the last, and the third episode's like 35 minutes. And like, don't get me wrong, the production value is through the freaking roof with this show. It looks incredible constantly.
But consistency is important.
I do like consistency. You're right. I like consistency. I like sitting down and knowing this is going to take me 45 minutes. This is going to take me an hour. And seeing each episode get shorter when there is so much other story out there is a little bit of a bummer. I think I'd rather them just make it 6 episodes and have each one be about an hour instead of 8 episodes and here's one that's a half hour.
I struggle with that too, because, you know, obviously we all love the content, we all love the things that they're doing with the show, so we want more. But then also, like, we all love Daredevil, right, when that came out, but then we were like, man, there's a lot of filler, they should have cut this down to be, you know, 8 episodes or whatever instead of 10 or 13 or however many it was. And I'm glad that they're not just adding filler for the sake of adding a padding out to an hour on each episode, but also I want more meaningful you know what I mean? Like, I'm at odds with myself, because even if it was filler, it could be cool filler, you know? And I don't know.
Well, that's kind of what I'm saying though, is like, they could, instead of it being an 8 episode count, make it 6 or 7, right? And have each one be about an hour.
Sure, right. But we don't know that they're not all these story things that you want done. We don't know that they aren't going to be doing those in what they have. I mean,
Well, right. But I guess what I mean,
so it's not like unexplored territory necessarily.
Yeah. But like, you're talking like episode 2 is really mainly filler.
Yeah.
Right. Like, the episode doesn't really serve much of a story purpose. Nobody really
grows. At least not yet.
I mean, I suppose
it could pay off later, I suppose. I'm thinking the Yoda eating the eggs.
Come back
thing.
Or, oh, okay.
No, I'm thinking the eggs thing with Yoda was something, you know, that was important.
Well, so to that end, you could have taken episodes 2 and 3, which combine for like an hour and 15 minutes, right? And cut down the ice planet stuff a bit and still had baby Yoda eat a few eggs, right? On that journey to the planet. That's all I'm trying to say. Like, I don't know. I just feel like the pacing is a little weird.
But they're wanting to keep the show running as long as they can. The more weeks that they have of the show, the better for them. So,
And I think that's the root of the problem, right?
Probably.
Is that people like I've heard a lot of people lean back on the, well, this gives the directors and the writers the freedom to tell the story they want to tell. And like, I don't think that's really what it is. I think it's what you just said. They want to stretch these out. They want people to subscribe. And if they can get to 8 weeks, then people are going to switch over. Now they've got 3 months of the service. Instead of two,
if they can keep it going until WandaVision comes out, Then they don't have any breaks on service. So if people want Star Wars and they want Marvel, and that's what the big ones they want on Disney. So, you know,
I think it's a very good point.
Yeah,
I do.
So I actually really liked episode 2. I don't think it has any specific weight on the rest of the series. I can't see any like connection, but I thought that a huge issue with Star Wars, and I'm just talking the 11 films, because that's what I've seen. I don't know the books, the games, the cartoons at all. So that's what I'm talking about. The original trilogy fails for me in the sense that Lucas created this massive universe, but never got to fill it out. And luckily, over the years, so many different creators have gotten that. But for me, there's so many different planets and peoples and customs that are not touched on in the films, that each episode where the Mando goes to a new planet and encounters new creatures and races makes me just absolutely overjoyed. Those ice spiders were absolutely terrifying, and as a storytelling situation, I really liked watching it. I thought it was a brief moment into like Star Wars horror. It reminded me of something that like John Carpenter would direct. You know, he would build an entire movie off of those things, but
and they would have been practical.
Yes. But like the two scenes they were in were absolutely well done, completely horrifying, like they served their purpose. So I really like the episodic nature of it. I like the Mando goes here, has to do this thing, and then he's able to move on. But I think that's just because so many shows feel like they need to have such a huge overarching plot now, and it has to be world ending, that I just like the scaled back nature of this.
I definitely agree on the sense that Star Wars hasn't done a great job fleshing out like all these different planets. They go to the same places all the time. But the fact that that episode didn't actually carry any weight to the story that we're all tuning in for, mm-hmm. That was what bothered me more than anything. Like, you can still go to new planets, and they did in episode 3, and see new things. I mean, when was the last time you saw a boat in Star Wars? And probably never. I don't, unless it happened in the kids' shows, I don't really understand, or I don't really remember any ever seeing a boat.
There's probably boats on Naboo.
Are there? Because there's like the things that go underwater, but there's not like a, just like a ship, like a ship that is on top of the water.
I don't know. I never thought to look, but I imagine Naboo's got to have some boats.
It just felt very grounded. I didn't try to bring it into argue semantics about, you know, maybe on some planet there was a boat that wasn't even barely shown. But the fact that there's like a whole scene in the water, you know, not with spaceships flying around in a Star Wars movie. I tell you what, seeing a bunch of Mandalorians fight a bunch of these alien squid guys on a ship in the middle of the ocean was really cool. It was so grounded, but still Star Wars. That was really neat. And I hope there's more of that, because, you know, you don't always need giant space battles and, like Rachel said, world-ending stuff. Like, seeing these grounded things happen that you can kind of relate to, that was really cool for me. And the only reason why I think that episode 2 might tie into the larger story, and this is a real far stretch, Yoda didn't actually like chew or seem to eat the eggs. He just like swallowed them whole. And I think maybe that, again, a stretch, maybe he's like able to keep them safe or something. And he wasn't actually eating them because the eggs seemed attracted to him.
But do you think he would have given them to the frog people then?
That was my theory at the end of episode two. So gotcha. I don't know that that necessarily holds its weight at this point, but
holds water.
Yeah, that was my hope that it was going to, you know, pay off and that the whole internet was going to feel bad because they demonized Baby Yoda for eating eggs when in fact he was just trying to help. But then
I want to be clear. I'm not demonizing him, but he's kind of a little jerk.
He has his moments, yeah. The whole spider thing was because of him, so.
That's true.
I am not upset about that. Little kids get into stuff all the time, but a little kid eating a baby's, like, species, like, last chance at survival, yeah.
It wasn't the species' last chance at survival. It was the bloodline's last chance at survival. Yeah, it was just okay. That one lady's.
You're fair.
It doesn't necessarily make it any better, but
he was killing off an entire bloodline.
Yeah, he wasn't like making a species extinct, at least.
That's fair. My bad. I think it's important that the character is an actual character right now, and I'm not upset about it because it's just one season so far. He's just merchandise, right? Now, he is the cutest fucking merchandise I've ever bought. And you will
continue buying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am not tired of him at all. But for this character to grow and be important, he needs to have flaws.
Agreed.
And that's the fair. Fact that he cannot help himself around like food is important.
I think it's great. And it's very much like a child, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, and he's all of a sudden very hungry. Like, in season one, he was not that hungry. There wasn't a lot of food scenes. I mean, there were, but he wasn't, like, gobbling other species, you know, all the time. He ate one frog, and then there's, like, some soup stuff. But
maybe he's about to have a growth spurt.
That's what I'm thinking, is that it's, like, a biological thing. Like, he's you know, calorie... I don't know. He's just
he's going to grow those last 3 inches that he gets.
Yeah. Hey, he's got a few more inches. Don't dog my man Yoda like that. For me, episode three so far, I wouldn't say it's my favorite because episode one was done better. But the standout for me in that episode was not Bo-Katan or any of those other characters. It was just seeing this cool water planet with docks and like aquatic species being the main draw there. There's just so much cool stuff that we haven't seen in Star Wars. And they're just, again, it was that kind of grounded feeling, right? Like we have docks here in the real world. And, you know, seeing a bunch of aquatic species there that we don't get to see very often in the Star Wars media was really cool. And I just hope that they do more with that kind of stuff, because that was neat for me. Beyond space battles and everything else, seeing that was cool.
I completely agree. I absolutely cannot stand that every single sci-fi and fantasy planet has like one kind of terrain. You know, Hoth is the ice planet. And
right, Tatooine is the sand planet.
Exactly.
Although now we have Jakku and whatever, you know,
right.
A couple others, but yeah.
So I'm glad to see something different. And yes. I don't know if this whole planet is a water planet, but water is not found in Star Wars very often. And aside from the really weird storm scene that we have where Rey kills Kylo, that's it. So this was really cool to see Ackbar's race doing what they do in their to make their society continue. Like, that was really cool. I was super excited by it.
Yeah, and it's these sailors in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. Like, come on, that's cool. Super awesome. Fishermen, you know?
Well, even just, like, the detail of how his ship was repaired.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, it's being held together with, like, nets and fishing rope and different, you know, wood planks and things of that nature. And I thought that was really clever because another sci-fi show like Star Trek would have just fixed the ship.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that would have been the end. Star Wars has
always been about like being dirty and grimy and not doing things right. That's been like what separates it from Star Trek in a lot of ways.
Yeah. But I think this took it even a step farther in a good way, in a very good way of showing the detail of that. Right. Cause like the Falcon gets beat up a lot in the movies, and short of it getting a new dish in the sequel trilogy, not a whole lot really gets patched, right? You're not seeing different panels or anything like that. This got to see that. You got to see a ship really get beat up and have it be repaired in a subpar way that felt very real. I liked that a lot.
And the weird cephalopod that came down at the end.
That was just creepy.
it totally was. But it goes with everything else that we've seen in that episode.
Also, the ship that he, or the like boat that he was on, it looked like a repurposed Hammerhead spaceship. Like,
oh,
we've seen him in some of the movies. If you look at it, it looks like one that they repurposed into a boat, which I thought was a really cool detail. It kind of goes along the same, like the speeder that the sheriff had in the first episode looked like a repurposed engine from a pod racer.
Yeah, it did.
So I like that we're seeing that now. Like those things we saw in the early movies are now not working as well, and they're being repurposed into other things. I think that's great. And I Filoni is wonderful, and I hope that he continues doing so much awesome stuff like this.
I'm glad you brought up the pod racer thing, because I had forgotten about that, and it was like the coolest thing, like such a great little detail.
Well, people are like, it's Anakin's pod racer. It's not fucking Anakin's pod racer. The universe isn't that small, okay?
But it is a pod racer engine, and I love that they took something from The Phantom Menace that was really there just for kids so they can make a video game.
But it was also a game cool
I love, by the way. Yeah, it's a cool scene. Or yeah. Group of scenes, I guess. And to see that technology survived in some capacity is fun.
And to still be used, nod. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was super cool. I'm glad it wasn't like him riding a full pod racer. That may have been maybe just a tidbit too much, but...
Yeah, I think they did just enough with it.
Yeah. And I think maybe that's the key here, is that what Filoni and Favreau have been able to do is really walk that line between... you know, fan service and just world building.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tough line to walk. It really is. And sometimes we want fan service, you know, but they've really walked that line well. And I think that's what helps make the show really successful from that standpoint. Now we do get more Mandalorians. We get Bo-Katan, who is a fan favorite of many, many people. She's played by Katie Sackhoff, who voiced the character on Clone Wars and Rebels. I'm a huge fan of her as an actor, so of course I'm glad that they brought her to actually play the character.
Ironhead Studios made those suits, by the way. Those same people that made the Batman v Superman suit.
Well, that's there you really go.
Cool.
Yeah. They've posted some behind the scenes pictures on their Facebook if anybody's interested in seeing those. Yeah, they turned out really neat. Definitely the standouts.
It was a cool collection of scenes, like when they're boarding the ship and it's trying to take off, and they're doing all of this during takeoff and fighting through, and you got to see some thermal stuff, which I thought was really cool. And the captain guy was, I thought, just, you know, kind of a good character. I thought he really handled all that well. It was just a good collection. I thought that the story in episode 3 was good. I just wish maybe it had been a little meatier.
As someone who appreciates action scenes, the best part of those Mandalorians for me was seeing how different they are than our Mandalorian. Like, you can tell that these are like soldiers trained in like group tactics, because the way they fought together was like flawless. It was, you know, they were all used to fighting together. They knew what each other was going to do. They were able to read each other and work together. Whereas, you know, our Mandalorian is a loner who's not used to having other people and working with other people. And he fights that way too. He's like, he'll let himself get punched if it knocks his helmet into somebody back behind him. You know, he does these things because he's used to being the only one there. So having them all fight together and seeing how different they were was really cool. And also finding out that that our Mandalorian's group was an extremist cult version.
Yeah.
And that he's actually like the extremist and not the normal one that was really cool too.
So same here, because it goes back to what I was saying, that every planet is just one thing, and forever I thought the Mandalorians were, you know, like, everybody is a bounty hunter / warrior, and everybody never takes their mask off, and everybody is like this. So I like seeing some diversity brought to it, and I like that he is completely unaware that he's the extremist.
Yeah, it was so great to see that. So cool. And yeah, I'm curious to see that. If he adopts, like, you know, and starts taking in things, because she's like the literal Mandalore, or has been in the past, and so, you know, you should probably listen to her, like,
right.
So, I mean, my theory there kind of falls in line with what Pedro Pascal wants, right? Because he wants to be the guy in the suit, and it's a lot easier to convince people to let him do that if he has to take the helmet off on a regular basis,
right?
Right. So if you start having it where he really only wears the helmet when he's on a mission and he's in combat or about to be, and he has the helmet off the rest of the time, then hey, he gets to be your guy.
Well, look at like Iron Man and Captain America, right, and Thor. Like, all these guys wear headgear, but they find any reason to take it off. I mean, exactly. Thor lost his headgear, you know, 10 minutes into the first movie. So, you know, it seems very likely that that's the way they're going. And I'm fine with it, because they're explaining it well. And it was a question a lot of people had after the first season. Why can Bo take her helmet off in the cartoons, but then this guy can't, you know, something's weird there. And that was how they explained it. And I thought that was really a great way of doing it. I'm hoping to see some growth from our Mandalorian about, you know, that he adopts the more widespread principles, and maybe that'll put him at odds with like the blacksmith armorer person and some of those people that he's worked with in the past.
This is fantastic. It's going to create new story opportunities for the writers. It's going to create conflict between the people that he is used to surrounding himself with and ones that he is surrounding himself with now. And it's going to create an opportunity for us to actually have Pedro Pascal more involved in the show, which is what he wants. So I think all around, the Bo-Katan storyline, it needs to continue. I think it's a good thing.
And I think that's a good note to end on this week. This section went a little bit longer than we really anticipated, because we covered three different episodes. So if we continue this, it'll be, you know, just covering whatever the next one is. But I think that's a good place to stop for us this week. Next week, we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of Tron Legacy. So we'll be discussing both Tron movies, I'm sure, to some extent next week. So those are available on Disney Plus as well, if you'd like to watch and then talk with us in chat about that, because we record this live Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern in our Facebook group, the Screen Heroes Podcast Forum. So you can find us facebook.com/group/Screen Heroes. We are doing a DC casting tournament. You can come vote for your favorite DC castings in the group as well. We post news and memes and other fun things. Of course, you can find us at Screen Heroes Pod on Twitter or heroespodcast.com. And the show is available for you to subscribe to on Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Spreaker, Podcast Addict, and so many more podcast services. I am the Star Trek dude. You can find me out there on Twitter. Ryan, where can people find you?
At Buster Props.
And Ray, where can people find you?
I'm at Siren Ray.
Fantastic. We are Screen Heroes on the Heroes Podcast Network. Thank you for joining us. We'll catch you next week.